You know that person that just seems to get like every single break? That person that always seems to get bumped up to first class? That person whose parents seem to pay for everything? Still? Those people that always get the benefit of the doubt? Those folks that are never associated with the negative members of their group? The world seems to literally bend over backwards for their smallest need. They set the agenda. They dictate the terms of the interaction. They seem to get every vacation request granted. And they get every break known to man. Yet they still have the gall to act like they're the ones persecuted? When it is in fact they who are in fact doing that very oppressing. Today's topic on the Inclusive Activism Podcast is the fourth and final installment on the series of Christian Hegemony. We will examine what and how current favoring practices exist, and we will look at how we can choose to resist these ubiquitous, unearned benefits. So taking time to check in, I am really pleased that as I spent the last couple weekends on a retreat teaching students to learn from and how to do more Kingian nonviolence conflict reconciliation in emerging leaders too. And I am always filled with this great sense of inner peace, and I'm always trying to find more and new ways to live in a more of a calm and nonviolent way. So the past few days for the podcast have been pretty good recently. I'm pretty excited about the fact that the last 2 days I have 20 and 10 downloads respectively, so I'm kind of seeing a little bit more growth. It seems as though if I post something, it's going to hit around 30 downloads for sure within the first week, if not the first week, the first 2 weeks for sure. So that's kind of nice. I'm getting some good movement happening. I'm working to try to figure out how to do Google Ads, and I have no idea how to do that, but I am trying nonetheless. And if anyone knows how to do Google Ads, please email me at inclusiveactivism@cox.net. I really need some help. So outside of that, I still need some breathing. I still need some peace and some help with other stuff. The only ad that I know how to use to push this comes from Facebook ads, and I still don't even know how to use Instagram enough to really make that work for me in my way. So if you know how to use Instagram really well and you know how to make an Instagram ad, I would appreciate the help, because I know more folks use Instagram than use Facebook specifically. I know Facebook's kind of for the old fogies, so I need some assistance with that. So help me out, reach out to me, give me some voicemails, give me some emails. It makes me feel like you know and I care about what we're doing here. I want to check in on my activism. I have been called to and got to advocate for in-state tuition for DACA recipients. That's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the Obama executive action that gave folks with that status the ability to legally be in the country. I got to teach for 4 days on nonviolence and to help make the world a more open and accepting and nonviolent space. I had a meeting to coordinate Anytown for curriculum, which was really nice. I appreciated that. And next weekend, I'm going to be starting Anytown, so after these next two podcast posts, be on the lookout for an interview with Eric Tanchez, the current executive director of Anytown. Really excited about that. I also got to attend a culture quest put on by Dr. Whitaker of Diamond Strategies, and that was how to create community. And I also got to take my dear friend Dr. Adama Salu to her first dinner at a Native American restaurant, which was awesome. She is a truly wonderful person, and she should be having a interview posting in the very near future too. So stay tuned. I have at least 3 dynamic interviews in the can already, and my next 2, I'm looking to really talk to some pretty dynamic folks, so I'm excited. Checking in my self-care. Self-care has been great recently. I have lifted at least 5 times a week the last couple weeks. My cardio has actually been excellent. I have done 4 times cardio. I might get to 5 tomorrow morning if I can bear the heat to do a little speed work. And my mindfulness has been great at 3 times a week. All that stuff might go outside of the window after this next week, because my niece Honey is coming into town, and she's going to be coming with me to Anytown. and I'm very, very much looking forward to that. I have also mixed in a new little self-care nugget, which has been walking prayer, and it's been nice because it's helping me meet some of my move goals while also giving me some time to connect with God. I also got to do my annual long walk. That's where I invite the Holy Ghost to come and meet with me, and I have to tell you about this story. So first off, yesterday, so that's July 7th. On July 7th, we usually like to go on this long walk, but we were supposed to get a package that day, which meant we might not get to go at all. So we were really bummed out by that a little early in the morning, and it was already getting incredibly hot. The temperature here reached like 117 degrees yesterday, and we were not looking forward to that. So that package got delivered. And we were kind of debating back and forth, should we go up, should we try it? And we were like, you know what? What the heck? We looked at the temperature and it was supposed to be like 97 degrees, which is not cool and or comfortable or what you'd want in a hike. But we were like, let's just go. It's important to do this. So we go up, and about the time we head into town, a rainstorm goes through Prescott. And we're only about, I'd say, 15 minutes away from our destination. Thumb Butte. So we're at Thumb Butte, and the temperature drops from like 96 to like 70, which was just magical. And we get out, and it's still raining a little bit, and we get the puppies out. We kind of get them in a good space, and there was just a beautiful breeze. I'm not lying when I say the temperature didn't get any higher for sure than 93, and the sun didn't peek back out for the whole walk. And we walked for a good, I want to say, hour and 20 minutes. It was special. And I can tell you that too, that day, we definitely felt as though, because we marked that day as special, and I think because we moved, you know, God met us and took us and held us. And I think that gave us a really special experience. And I think we both felt recharged, and it for sure held up and connected with the Lord because we had taken some time to just take a long walk and listen. And it was really beautiful. Moving on, also I'd like to ask you for our weekly, please remember to rate and review us, share this podcast with others if there is real value there. Please remember to subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or your pod server of choice. That way you don't miss an episode, and it's always delivered in a timely manner. And those rate and reviews make a huge difference for us. We're still standing at just 3 of those, and I really, really need us to kind of get a little bit more reviews up there, because it's going to make a big difference in how visible that podcast is. On to today's podcast topic, Christian hegemony and how does it manifest today in ways which firmly keep Christian privilege in place to the point it is considered a given. So one way is in United States foreign policy. Many different groups are advocating for the Christian influence to be a major factor on the world stage. Groups like The Family and the Council for National Policy, which are both powerful international Christian missionary/aid organizations, as well as the World Vision Networks, are organizations of Christian power and privilege personified. You see this in such proclamations as either you are with us or you're against us. Not a lot of wiggle room there, and there's not a lot of room for discussion or negotiation when you're either with us or you're against us. This is also allows for the framework for preemptive strikes for those that are framed or deemed as aggressors against popular Christian narratives, which also then furthers Christian dominance and helps frame it as humanitarian aid or relations of rescue. The United States finds itself spreading a dominant Christian ideology and repressing those seen as non-Christian. An example of this is in Haiti. When a disaster strikes in Haiti, the U.S. aid is always substantial and needed, but the U.S. has also long supported U.S. policies which have deliberately impoverished Haiti and have supported U.S. prop dictators. Manifest destiny and war. For long periods of time, the U.S. involvement on a world stage was seen as, in part, a positioning for Christians for the second coming, or otherwise known as the seemingly righteous death of everyone not Christian. U.S. support for the Holy State of Israel might have been in direct correlation to the Bible stating that the Jewish people need to be in the Holy Land for the rapture to take place. Though polls constantly show, Americans are very reluctant to go to war, either for isolationist concerns or
over concerns of fiscal and human costs. We find over and over again that many Christian groups in support of such moves could be against the war, but are always baited into the idea that this might be the war to end all wars, aka the Second Coming. This also leads to the framing of others as the Antichrist many times in foreign wars. This goes back to even Abe Lincoln being framed by the Southerners as the Beast. U.S. General Boykin stated in his battle with the war, said, "I knew my God was bigger than his God. I knew that my God was a real God and his God was an idol. And I knew that George Bush was in the White House because God put him there." These are very troublesome things to say in an interfaith world when we are involved in geopolitical combat. We also see this in international influence. Since the mid-20th century, many Christian fundamentalist groups have works in place and two trusts to influence both foreign and domestic policy. One is to create close relationships with those who have direct power or influence and with those who have policy decisions worldwide. Or they focus their efforts on keeping popular opinion, activists, or votes in their favor in which to build political persuasion. Forces like the group The Family want to create a worldwide government under God, and they see themselves as a guerrilla force on the spiritual battlefield. Wow. They are also known to financially support dictators with similar worldviews. Such an initiative as the Silk Road Strategy was offered up by The Family. Seriously, how culty is that name, The Family? So anyway, Sam Brownback did this. He wrote and championed a bill designed to block the growth of Islam in Central Asian nations to strategically control resources of oil and gas in Central Asia. They also have ties to Uganda in support of legislation that supports the death penalty for homosexuals. And this has been happening for a long time in Uganda. Americans go over there, really get people very excited about Christianity and very, very fundamentalist forms of Christianity. And then people come up with notions like any homosexual should be put to death in Uganda, and U.S. Americans are paying for this? With family like this, who needs enemies? NGO and faith-based funding. The U.S. supplies a certain amount of grant funding to deal with certain issues related to health and wellness. A lot of this gets tied up in abstinence-only education, and little goes to non-Christian groups specifically. This money can go to pay for Bible study programs, youth programs, and collect money for special projects. A lot of it can get taken up in the form of missionary work. An example of this gone wrong was in Kutubunda in the Chittagong region, which was after a cyclone. Workers demanded that people were to switch their faith in order to receive aid. Now, this was federal aid from the United States. That's amazing. Could you imagine, like, your family just got devastated by some type of hurricane or cyclone, and you're in desperate, desperate need, and you're asked to renounce your faith in order to receive the aid? The funny thing is you see similar types of things being proclaimed to Christians at the time of the tribulation across the rapture, where it's said that people are going to force Christians to renounce their faith in order to be taken care of or not be put to death, and that they have to die in order to remain Christian. So it's just amazing that these same people are the same people putting this on others. And also, think of it, when there is a natural disaster, who is there first and what policies do they have? Usually it's the Red Cross or the Salvation Army, and these are groups that I know the Salvation Army specifically still practices discrimination against the LGBT community. Even when tasked with education in a distant land, Christianity is used as a basis of the means in which to structure the lessons and values, even in a directly religious conflicted area when they have different views. So think about that. They're basing a lot of that thought of Christianness in areas where Christianity is not the dominant religion, but we pay for that stuff because we see Christianity is right. We see similar things happen with U.S. domestic policy. We see it in political involvement. Though it is noted that Christian organizations have the same benefits as, say, a Muslim organization would, they are technically legally equal, although it is very important to note that one is seen as right and moral, and the other one is subject to either severe surveillance or almost gets no similar protections given the value placed on our society of Christianity versus Islam specifically. The non-Christian groups are always regularly monitored, critiqued, and their funding sources are often investigated. And many times their leaders are painted with broad stereotypes and are seen as either too religious or too extreme. Although it's funny, because if you look at, say, Mike Pence, and if he were a Muslim and refused to be alone in the company of women other than his wife, we would see him very differently than we might see him with his current Christian identity. Still, it's a little weird that you can't be around a woman, I think. But it is clear, when it is time for political involvement on our domestic stage, it is much easier to pass policy and have members of the family as supporters than if one were, say, Buddhists. These religious exemptions and benefits are in place and serve to protect Christian power and privilege almost exclusively. It kind of reminds me of this whole separate but equal notion, but we also know that too was far from the case. So while the rules are supposed to work the same way, we clearly see a very big favoring for Christians specifically. Another way we see this manifest is within workers' rights. Religious institution has long been seen as safe havens from many different public worker demands. They act as shields of protections from lawsuits and laws protecting pensions to unemployment benefits or the legal ability to unionize. For example, the Seventh-day Adventist Church has over 44,000 employees but does not allow for unions. The church's denial comes from the idea that collective bargaining defies Christ's admonition that behavior must be directed by individual conscience and is inherently disruptive with the church's healing mission. I've seen similar grumblings in Arizona when we just voted to raise the minimum wage, and many faith-based groups said they couldn't afford to pay their workers a living wage and keep doing their work. And this notion is just shocking to me. The work is more important than the fact that you're going to keep your workers in a space where they can't afford to feed their families. How is that a job? If it's supposed to be volunteerism, then they should be volunteering. But if it's a job, it's a job, and that job should pay. If you're not even taking care of your own people, then how are you living Christ's message? Sorry, religious rant over. Then there is another notion called the ministerial exception, which has been in place since 1872 and was furthered in 2012 and excluded any activity by a religious organization, including any religious employment, from legal scrutiny if it involves a worker who is considered to be doing work that is a core expression of their religious belief by their employer. So if I made this religion a podcast, basically, I would be exempt from legal redress for acts of discrimination. People have been fired for having breast cancer, for being gay, for growing old, for having sex outside of marriage, or becoming disabled. Could you imagine the local Circle K getting away with something like that? They are also allowed to only hire people from a similar faith backgrounds. And these institutions, they're not paying taxes, but they're allowed to do this? We also see that they're granted religious immunity from persecution. Many times, civil authorities find it difficult to persecute religious institutions in child abuse cases due to the fact that the U.S. has an act called the U.S. Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, and it claims the First Amendment protections. This has allowed churches to harbor known child molesters, refusing to disclose records, minimizing impacts of sexual abuse, moving abusers to different communities. This has been done by the Catholic Church, the Mormon Church, as well as Jehovah's Witnesses. Many times, they have used local influence to hush these same allegations. These laws grew out of a sense that Christian institutions are bastions of moral virtue, and they were assumed to be innocent. Salt and light is what they say in the Bible helps keep corruption and negativity from happening. Those things are supposed to cure all wounds. Oversight, salt and light, these are things that are supposed to cure these problems, not just trusting people to their own moral authority. Another space where we see this overwhelmingly favoring behavior is in tax breaks specifically. Elizabeth Cady Stanton stated, Christian institutions benefit from billions of dollars in special tax treatment for the organization and their employees, including exemptions on tax from personal income as well as payroll taxes. These protections also help to procure tax-exempt construction loans for religious projects, also with other 501c3s. Christian houses of worship have long been granted exemption from local taxes on property in every state. For example, Colorado lists $1.1 billion tax revenue in local property tax specifically. The collective loss across all states from all religious land that they could be collecting money is over $600 billion. Also, most tax-exempt bonds go to Christian organizations. It has become a form of public subsidy for these organizations. The loss of this tax income means that the rest of the community must pay more to make up that difference. More than $20 billion has been issued in tax-exempt bonds since 1985 to support ideas or things like a Baptist retirement home or a Presbyterian housing project in Missouri. Also, since 1957, the parsonage exemption has shielded clergy from taxes on the entire portion of their paycheck designated to living arrangements, mortgage, rent payments, utilities, furnishings, as well as upkeep. In 2012, this has resulted in a loss of $1.2 billion. Now, this tax break is not allowable to staff at secular nonprofits who reach the same groups as religious groups. Or is this same exemption allowed for poorly paid teachers or daycare workers who also serve their communities? The only difference between these groups of people are one of these groups of people are Christian and one of these groups of people aren't or not associated with a Christian organization specifically. And because of these tax breaks, the average family must pay an extra $1,000 every single year. An overwhelming amount of wealth has been accumulated by these groups to the order of $232 billion, and we continue to subsidize these groups over other mom-and-pop, say, daycares who do not get these same exemptions. Christian values are at the heart of many structures in our healthcare system. Reproductive rights, favoring of heteronormative marriage, abortion, birth control are all under the control of primarily Christian people. Contraception was long delayed due to the notion that sex was dirty unless for procreation specifically. Abortion is still placed as a burden to non-Christians today and has been under attack. Some people see this as a single issue vote and have since 1972. Since 1977 and 2011, there have been about 175,000 incidents of violence or disruption at abortion clinics when people are in dire situations and they're trying to seek aid. As a Christian, I'm disgusted by the statistic. We also see abstinence-only sex education, and it has been the norm since the Reagan era and since the W. Bush administrations, and are still the dominant form of local public sex ed received. We place this on people who do not identify with our religion, as though them following this one legal rule will save them. Isn't that the one thing that our religion says? You have to accept Jesus and that's the way we get to heaven? Not that you follow our abstract rules that are just for our groups. 13% of all hospitals are religious, and 18 of all hospital beds are in religious hospitals. 70% of these beds are Roman Catholic. 13% of these hospitals are Roman Catholic. The rest were mostly Christian, and a handful were Jewish. Problems arrive when Christian values are placed on these visitors. Why is it others have the right to say when a right-minded person can choose to die of terminal illness? These same institutions were accused of dragging their feet on AIDS and HIV when it was framed as a form of gay retribution. It was also found that Catholic hospitals only allow for emergency contraception for 23% of rape victims. This disproportionately affects more poor rural folks where there are many fewer hospitals to choose from. We see these religious fights against birth control by Christian values, even though the voters and the people have voted to provide birth control as part of their healthcare packages. No one wants people who don't want babies to have babies. It's mean to babies. Who's anti-baby? Just because someone has a baby doesn't mean they're going to have the means or ability to love that baby. You should want a baby. Everyone should have a parent that wanted to have them, or has the means and the ability to support them. And I don't know why we create legislation that makes people have children, regardless of their financial ability to do so. We also see people promoting abstinence versus harm reduction. And it seems that since dominant Christianity is more about saving souls than it is about saving lives. And damn it, that makes no sense if the one road to heaven is supposed to be Jesus Christ. Sin is about moral choices like lust, gluttony, sloth, rather than need. Lazy people are not fed. People with babies should control their lust and figure out their child. Although this is never the case when Christians have an unwanted pregnancy in their family. Somehow they find a way to get this abortion taken care of and are forgiven of that sin. The war on drugs is another example. 25% of 2 million people are locked up because they need care for their mental health addiction. Not because punishment is going to figure that out. 80% of the increase in drug arrests are from marijuana. Now, I've never seen someone on pot steal, rob, fight, or whatever. It is a depressant. That is more about legislating morality than crime prevention. It seems Christian values are more about individual responsibility, guilt, repentance, and punishment. Treatment only occurs after the punishment, where we are seeing the same trend play out again now with abortion. These values fly in the face of harm prevention methods like needle exchanges or drug treatment programs first instead of punishment. Harm reduction approaches the understanding that human behavior is complex, and we must work to first establish the quality of an individual and community life as well as well-being. This calls for non-judgmental, non-coercive provision of services and resources to be given, just given to people. I don't know about you, but if I were to hear about God from this type of person, I'd probably be a lot more apt to listen. We also see this influence on domestic policy in the war against women. So roughly 77% of the populace, the U.S. populace, supports abortion. But it always seems like it's under attack. And at times, it is the sole concern of Supreme Court justices when they're about to be appointed. The concern is, do they support Roe versus Wade or not? Over 1,100 bills were introduced in state legislatures to in some way stop local abortions in 2011. And the current state version of the American Health Care Act, or Trump Care, eliminates one full year of funding for Planned Parenthood. The current version of the American Health Care Act, aka Trump Care, eliminates 1 year of funding for Planned Parenthood. And for no other reason but to just make it harder to plan one's ability to be a parent. Already, no federal dollars can be spent on abortions. So why are you taking this money away from Planned Parenthood already? The role of women, as it has been framed by Christianity, is for women to be in the home, caring for children, and subservient to men. And we see this with many domestic care issues. Women are not allowed to be in positions of authority and are always framed as seeing the need for control due to their sexual/emotional states. We also see this with marriage, specifically with Prop 8 in California. Prop 8 was something that was pushed by the Mormon Church specifically to make marriage deemed as only between a man and a woman. And I've talked about this several times in the Christian Hegemony podcast about my thoughts on marriage. We also see it in domestic violence. Canon law allowed at one time the right of husbands to beat their wives, just not too badly. When men are charged with the abuse of women, they will claim those women need it. And this notion has been forged by years and years of Christian ideology. Still today, despite the institution of legal penalties, a substantial number of men still feel this need to control or correct their women. And too often, male judges let men off easy because this seeing this need to control women. Remember the phrase that we heard before, wait until your father gets home? This too is also part of a pattern of domestic violence, which is seen as sanctioned violence, which is allowed in the privacy of the home. Again, just because one is a man doesn't give you the ability to control or dictate the lives or emotion of others. I wish more women were in control versus men, because men have a lot of like personal work to do. But this domestic violence stuff, it gets set at a U.S. on a policy stage specifically. We also see this in parenting. The notion of sparing the rod spoils the child also creeps into other aspects of life very deeply. Physical discipline is used to correct children at a rate of roughly 80%. The message is not so much about being able to discern about what's right and wrong, as the inherent message is to comply. There is even a disorder in the DSM, the American Psychiatric Association Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Disorders, which you also might remember from such hits as LGBTness being a mental issue. And this disorder is called oppositional defiance disorder. From symptoms resulting as just being angry or refusing to comply or cooperate with authority, that is a mental disorder. The inclusion of this particular diagnosis points to the moral values and how they can be secularized while also giving the veneer of scientific authority with its rationale. And one of the last places we see it was in education. Some quick hits here. Nationwide, textbooks reflect Christian history and Christian values up to and including the notion of intelligent design, which, according to the scientific method, cannot be verified. We also see this happen in education with the distribution of Bibles in the classrooms, at see you at the flagpole prayer gatherings, the wide adoption of the character ethic in education curriculum, and the amount of churches who rent schools for their Sunday gatherings all seek to normalize this notion of Christian hegemony. So next up, we're going to look at how we can resist dominant Christian hegemony. For Christians and their own resistance to Christian dominance, there have always been Christian dissidents, people who have rejected dominant interpretations of the meaning of Christianity or the role of the church, especially in greater society. Others have worked very hard to rethink the notion of the church as well as church life. Some organizations that are like this are First Corinthian Baptist Church in Harlem, New York, our Sojourn Grace Collected, both of which you have the ability to stream via podcast as well. Many back in the day also spoke out against the injustices of the day. In the Crusades, it was Peter Alibard. Alibard spoke against the notion of original sin in the beginning. Another person, Heloise, was a 12th century dissenter, and he rejected the worship of violence and demonization of sexuality. He also was against the valorization of suffering and penance. Heloise also offered love grounded in honesty, mutual care, obligation, and the responsible uses of power. Another man, Alonso de Salazar y Freris, was an inquisitor whose reports led to the suppression of witch burnings in the Spanish Empire a century before the rest of Europe ended them. Roger Williams was the first person to coin the phrase wall of separation, which came to be known the separation between church and state. Women have also led in these movements, like Anne Hutchinson, who had been described as an American Jezebel who had gone a whoring from God, also helped to challenge many Christian patriarchal notions. Many female-only religious communities taught girls to read and created safe havens for women. they also started abolitionist movement and were against Native American removals. Women are always at the heart of many, many good things, especially in history. But we don't get to hear about these things because the patriarchy doesn't want you to. This history of the rise of the challenge to overturn slavery was better documented, but is still yet more of an untold story. Though it was true at the time, many churches were in support of slavery due to pro-slavery passages in the Bible, there were also many others that were active against and served in abolitionist movements, or were part of the Underground Railroads. These and many other brave notions mentioned in this section demonstrate the role Christians can play as allies in the struggle to uproot Christian hegemony. Now, the path is not easy, and many had been persecuted. But personally, deeply within my own heart, I feel this is the type of persecution we're supposed to be subject to as Christians. This is the persecution we should be looking to experience, given the amount of harm Christian hegemony has inflicted on the world. There has also been resistance outside of Christianity. Some groups had to fight against Christians for mere survival. The Roma, the Jews, the Native Americans had to set up ways to maintain autonomy and how to learn how to keep non-hierarchical cooperative co-ops in order to keep their way of life intact. The term decolonization has almost come to mean de-Christianization of many hegemonic practices. An example of this is the Takawi Oni Monument, which is a religious collaboration with the United Andean Nations against the Spanish in the 1560s, and it was an example of Native resistance. Enslaved Africans in the U.S. also engaged in this persistent type of resistance, and it manifested in many, many different ways. Suicide, running aways, burnings, revolts, poisoning, infanticide, deception, refusal of food, and learning to read, as well as other acts of solidarity, fought against notions of subservient Christian dominance. In fact, many social justice movements were created to fight or eliminate broad-based Christian dominance. Not Christians, not Christian sex, or Christianity. Efforts to enforce imperialism were the part of this social justice movement. These social justice movements were to keep the accumulation of wealth and power in the hands of the few at the cost of the many. Another way you can push against this idea is to just talk about Christian hegemony. Most people have no framework of knowledge in which to discuss this form of anti-imperialism. There are no college classes, there are no major lawsuits or popular media in which to discuss this form of social control. So when the issue of Christian hegemony's powerful and destructive role is raised, people will get defensive or they'll just avoid the issue entirely. Here are some common Christian denials which come from page 183 of Paul Kivel's book on Christian hegemony. These are denials you're going to hear when you try to talk about this. This isn't a Christian-based society, it's a secular one. Your examples are trivial. Many expressions are generic or spiritually neutral. Some of these traditions are pre-Greek or Jewish or pagan in their roots. Christianity has also inspired social justice, activism, and liberation. It is only the far-right Christians that do these things. It is too broad a brush to paint all Christians with. But there's also many good Christians. Christian institutions have nothing to do with what Jesus taught. I've used this for too many years. Most people are Christians, so they should dominate. Christians are in fact victimized. It's really the Jews that control everything. Or I'm not Christian, and it's not my problem. So living this lifestyle, one of the things that you can do to live this lifestyle is in public settings or forums to apologize for slavery or apologize to all the harm that had been done to natives. I'm reading this directly from Paul Kibble's book on page 193. Apologies for slavery or to Native Americans are useful as a first step, but they usually ignored the deep and ongoing patterns of racism and Christian dominance within a denomination. The core issue is the cessation of oppression and reparations, including the return of land. Archbishop Desmond Tutu was quoting as saying, "If you take my pen, what does an apology do if you still have my pen?" If it is based on an understanding of Christian dominance, joining interfaith organizations can be a powerful way to build religious pluralism and encourage other churches to step up on these issues. Also, if you're going to be living this as a lifestyle, then you also really need to think about how you center your energy or how you calm yourself with self-care. What activities are you going to do to connect you to the greater and wider reality? And how can you continue to choose to expand that circle of experience? So the three walkaways from today's podcast are: Christian hegemony is here. And when you see how many current practice favor Christians, it's staggering and it's overwhelming. And honestly, it's difficult to see and it's difficult to take in. But the other thing is, we can resist this. If we are the Christians, we can live fuller lives outside of just our Christian experience. We can work to undo Christian dominance. And if you are not, you might also choose to help and save a Christian like myself from living a life which is in direct opposition from the things that we seem to base our personal understanding on. And we all can choose to live bigger and fuller lives outside this notion of Christian hegemonic dominance. And third, we are all better off without these poisoning, oppressing influences and unfair practices in our lives. It doesn't seek any way to bring us together, and we see the slow dying of Christianity because of these practices. Again, this has been really hard for me specifically to talk about, given my Christian identity and really owning the pain that my religion has caused on people. It's also difficult because I'm a native person, and I also understand the amount of pain which has been done to native communities by Christianity specifically. But I need help with this. Just the fact that I'm here talking to you about this is my first step. And you listening to this is your first step. But we're here and we're together. And I'm determined not to leave you alone in this fight. And I hope you won't leave me alone in my struggle, because I really see a deep need for us to find a way to get better at this, to not do this to other people. I think there's a lot of people that claim to be Christian that might not make it into heaven because of the way they act. And morality has nothing to do with religion. We need to find ways to be better people. And without us challenging and holding one another to be that better person, we're never going to create a world worth living in. I don't know that hell is a space outside of this world, but I also don't know that heaven's a space outside of this world either. I think we've experienced glimpses of both, and we have to find ways to give more of that heaven, that connection, that interconnectedness, nirvana, to one another, if the world's going to be the place we truly hope it will be. So in closing, if this made you think of something, if this hurt your feelings in the same way it hurt mine, if this has you mouth agape and you have no idea what to do next, call me and let me know. You can reach me at 860-576-9393. Again, this is the Inclusive Activism Hotline at 860-576-9393. But talk to me. Let me know how you're feeling. I could really use someone to talk to with this. Because I've been talking about it with my partner specifically, but there's only so much she can do. I need to have the experience of someone else that struggled through this as well. That voicemail space, that is a place for us to ask questions, for you to hit me with different scenarios, to tell me how you're thinking or feeling about these things in kind of a real-time space. And also, if you think of a really amazing topic that you'd like me to cover in the future, I'd also love to make it a future podcast specifically. Remember to please go on to iTunes and rate and review us. Remember to subscribe and make sure you're getting the Inclusive Activism Podcast downloaded to you when they're hot and fresh off the presses. And also, if you're interested in booking me and bringing the power of inclusive activism to your organization, you can do so at inclusiveactivism.cox.net. And if you want to learn more about this organization, you can do so at www.inclusiveactivism.com. Oh, also, The Inclusive Activism Podcast is on Facebook. So if you're on Facebook and you're not a fan of that page, please look up The Inclusive Activism Podcast and like the page. I release the updates on there. And if you know how to use Google Ads, please get a hold of me and help me out. Thank you so much, and I appreciate you taking your time. I can't wait to get a hold of you and talk to you about the next deep and thoughtful topic in the very, very near future. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.